The Chilpack Hollywood live event of the week.
Are you back from Melbourne, Dean Haglund?
I certainly am, Phil Arness.
You're safe.
What an exciting time it was.
Safely ensconced back in Sydney. What was going on there in Melbourne?
Well, it was called the AMC Expo. That stands for the Australian Movie and Comic Book Expo, which was formerly known as Armageddon Con. But when you were flying in from the U.S. and they said at the customs, "Why are you here?" And then you said Armageddon Con, he thought something else. So they widely changed the name.
Of course, you'd been to that event before.
Yes, I was there in 2011, and that was there with the other two lone gunmen.
I remember that.
Yeah.
And I heard when you were there that time that copies of The Truth Is Out There were flying off the shelves. Did that happen this time as well?
No.
Did you bring any?
Well, no. I ran out, and I've been waiting to get up to Gold Coast to get some more.
You don't even have Blu-rays. You didn't bring enough Blu-rays, did you? The kids love the Blu-rays, especially internationally, because there's no loss in quality there. But what was going on there? Did you do a little comedy?
Did a little one-man hilarity, and that's what flew off my table, the USB drives that have the comedy show on it. Remember, with the old days, we were burned DVDs. Well, now the technology is you get a little flash drive that I sign that's got the show on it. So how is that?
And did Lou Diamond Phillips participate in this show?
Damn it, he did not. But we did have dinner. It was me, Peter Shinkoda of the Lady Killers, and a few others went out to dinner. And Lou Diamond Phillips, that guy is a plethora of hilarious stories.
But I thought I saw a photo of you on stage with him. Did I not?
You saw a photo of us on a stage, but not the stage.
And that stage was leaving to get you back to Sydney. No, what?
Yeah.
I see. I saw you on a stage. I mean, I did notice that there was nary a soul in the audience on that show.
Yeah, exactly. But that would be a bad sign.
I thought you were like, you know, you guys were doing a run through. You were basically hipping him rehearsal. To that. The rehearsal, the structure of what was going to happen on an improv show.
If only that was the case. But unfortunately, that was already after I had done the show. That was the photos you saw. Was us at the historic Anthem Theater in Melbourne.
Sure.
Which is a lovely 1874 theater that we got a private tour of after the dinner by the manager of the restaurant we went to in Melbourne. So he said, "Oh, no, I got the keys to this theater. Would you like to see it?"
So,
and I perked up about my love of historic theaters around the globe and got a walkthrough.
Did that place feel haunted?
Surprisingly, it did not. I've felt very in many more theaters that felt very more haunted than that one. It felt actually somewhat underused, actually.
Hmm.
I know.
So I'm going to have to wait then, I guess. Well, and I would have been disappointed if I'd missed, obviously, you as Jaime Escalante, calculus teacher, in your live improv stand and deliver with Lou Diamond Phillips. So I guess it's best that it waited.
That is a great reference.
I mean, I knew the teacher's name. That's good. I remember it sadly like it was yesterday. Remember, you know, down in MacArthur Park, right? There's that wonderful mural of Jaime Escalante.
Yeah, yeah.
Actually.
That I believe they're restoring even.
So what's next? What's the next stop for you? The next convention, the next live performance? What's next?
Next will be in 3 weeks. I'll be in Adelaide. But before that, what am I talking about? I will be performing my one-man show right here in Sydney at the Aliza 505 venue. It's called Venue 505, and it's on number 5 Aliza Street right in Newtown.
And what will that one-man show entail?
Well, that will be a Paper Laughs show. So basically, it's free if you don't laugh. And then on your way out, you determine what that show is worth to you, and you pay on the way out.
That would explain why your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour is free every week.
Exactly, because we, you know, you earn based on performance, and why should comedy be any different?
We'll certainly look forward to hearing about that on future live events of the week. Yep. I attended a live event of the week, and you would have been very proud of me. I mean, it was at the Los Angeles Breakfast Club, but at my behest, they booked the grandson of Clifford Clinton. The grandson of Clifford Clinton. Of course, Clifford Clinton was a son of a famous restaurateur who had opened Clinton's Cafeteria in San Francisco, a huge success, came down here and with his final $2,000 opened a cafeteria. He used a name to differentiate it from his father's restaurant. He combined his first name and his last name and created Clifton's. And
of course,
it's an exciting time because Clifton's Brookdale, which was, I guess, the third Clifton's restaurant in downtown Los Angeles, has now been remodeled and is reopened. And it's quite exciting. I'm actually going to have a bit of a birthday party there, Dean Hackney.
What?
Anyway, so it was so exciting. Visitors to Los Angeles need to check out Clifton's, not only because it's super cool, but it is, as you point out, such an important landmark, not only in terms of architecture and in terms of dining and in terms of the history of Los Angeles, but also in terms of humanitarianism and the progressive movement in Los Angeles. You once hit me to the fact that Clifton's was responsible for many, many people surviving the Great Depression.
Absolutely. They were one of the first restaurants to offer credit just based on your name. So before credit cards, if you didn't have money, you didn't eat. But you could go to Clifton's. They would serve up a meal, and then you would sign your name, and they would give it to you on credit. And then theoretically, when you're up on your feet, you'd come back and pay for the meal.
I mean,
of which many people did. They apparently made 88 cents on the dollar, so losing only 12 cents.
But you have to front that money, and you never know, and you don't know if it's going to happen. But, you know, in addition to that, at one of the other restaurants, they offered penny a meal tickets where you could buy these tickets to give to people so that they could eat for a penny a meal. There was, of course, you know, so many programs that these restaurants. After the war, when GIs came back and they were having a hard time finding jobs because the aerospace industry was booming in Los Angeles and Southern California, but not so fast as to outnumber the amount of GIs who were coming home. The GIs would eat for free. And the other thing about this, and it's hard for me to imagine this given what the food at Clifton's was like before the remodel, but it was really healthy food for that time.
Absolutely. It was Clifton's grandma, wasn't it, who was going in every day to do quality control?
I think so. Yep. It was family recipes. And so a great bit of the humanitarian history, but also Clifford Clinton himself, who opened it, was a real major figure in the progressive movement in Los Angeles to try to clean up the city, the corruption in the city, especially in the police department. And one of the things that I learned from his grandson was that Clifford Clinton lived on the corner of Los Feliz and Western, right on that corner where AFI now stands. And in 1937, the LAPD blew up his house. Maybe it wasn't the LAPD. It was people who were upset with his probes into the corruption in Parker Center. And
so burnt it right down?
Blew it up. You damn dirty apes, you blew it up.
Oh, my God.
So anyway, so that
what year was that?
1937. And so I realized that if he lived there in 37 in this neighborhood, he must have attended a breakfast club or two in his time. So we're going back through the records, through the photo archives, trying to find a picture of Clifford Clinton. Anyway, that is your live events of the week. Like I said, many exciting live events coming up. Your comedy shows, Lily Holloman starring in the 25th anniversary production of Beth Henley's Abundance at South Coast
Rep. How exciting are those photo shoots, too.
I'll be reporting on that next week. But after our little opening theme song, we have a lawsuit of the week that dovetails quite nicely with live events of the week. Did I mention an opening theme song, Dean Haglund?
What?
And now, your Chilpack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness.
Phil, Dean, what will it be today? Now intercontinental, LA to Australia. It's your Chilpack Hollywood Hour.
Our good friend David Dean Bottrell participated in the filing of a lawsuit, Dean Haglund, against his very own Equity Union.
What?
This is the union that represents stage performers. And David, who has been on this show before, was on September, I think, 2 years ago. We might want to Skype in with him. He now lives in New York. We might want to, you know, hear from him directly about this. But I thought it certainly deserved to be our lawsuit of the week.
Absolutely. What's this about?
The Chilpack Hollywood Lawsuit of the Week.
Thank you, Garrett Watley. L.A. actors are suing their union, Equity. There are currently, as David Dean Bottrell wrote, there are currently two remarkable shows, Spring Awakening on Broadway and Lost Girls off Broadway, that began in theaters under L.A.'s 99-seat plan.
Right.
For people who are not aware, this is a plan that was adopted by Equity, by the union that represents stage actors, to allow actors within the Los Angeles zone to donate their skill and their talent to plays, provided the venue were 99 seat or less. The idea being that these are the kind of venues that can never afford to pay for professional theater. And these actors who make their living in television and film might not have the time to pursue and do an Equity show, but this allows them to continue to experiment, to continue to develop their own craft, while at the same time, hopefully, developing plays like these two that David wrote about that are now the toast of New York and making the actors in them a nice amount of money. So this was the idea behind the 99-seat plan. A year ago, the Equity Union leadership ignored a wildly majority vote on the part of all LA members to keep the 99-seat plan. They turned a deaf ear, and according to David, apparently feel that they are qualified to decide what's best for us. Again, according to David, it's time for that leadership to wake up or step down. L.A. Equity members sued to create the 99-seat plan. We are now suing to keep it. I completely applaud and support the goal of this lawsuit, and I hope it is successful. Those are the words of David Dean Bottrell. Interesting.
Wow. That's really interesting. Now, this has to... I mean, this, of course, goes back to why they discontinued the 99-seat plan in the first place.
What do you mean?
Which Equity said we can't carry on the 99-seat plan anymore. We'll just leave it open so it doesn't matter. Like, I was just leaving when that was collapsing.
Yeah, so they gave 1 year where it can continue, but then that's pretty much it. You know, if the actors themselves are the producers of the piece, then they can get a waiver. But basically the 99 seat plan is no more. You have to pay the actors apparently minimum wage for all rehearsals and all production. And some people might say, well, what's the big deal? You know, but most actors they don't want to set a standard of working for minimum wage, first of all, right? They either want to be paid union rates or they want to donate their time and their services.
Yeah.
And to be told they can't, especially, again, with all the good things that have come of it, realize that Los Angeles was a dead theater town before the 99-seat plan, and it was the 99-seat theaters that made L.A. theater viable. And now, you know, thankfully, L.A. does have a thriving theater scene, but it wouldn't have been possible without the 99-seat plan. So it's really going to be interesting, but I did not know that, again, the L.A. actors had to sue to create that plan in the first place.
I didn't realize that either.
So that will be exciting. Something to keep an eye on. And like I said, maybe we should have some special guests who come in and when I say come in, I mean stay where they are and Skype in with us. Dean Haglund, did you see a movie directed by a female that everyone should see?
Well, unfortunately, it was a super busy week, so I have to say no.
So, yeah, the women can fend for themselves on a super busy week.
Oh, my gosh. It's not that I didn't want to. It's just, you know, hours in the day, my friend.
I was getting kind of depressed, actually, to be honest with you, that I'm watching one of these each week, and I stopped all of a sudden. I wondered, well, but wait a minute. Why are these the only films directed by women that I'm seeing? Like, I see a couple new movies a week. How come these aren't ever directed by women? What's the deal? You know, and I'm going to see what's playing at the Directors Guild. It's not like I'm ignoring it. That's where I go. These are the new releases. I try not to learn anything about them in advance because I know I'm going to see them. But lo and behold, they always turn out to not be directed by women, which I guess means they are directed by men. But I was heartened to see that movie Suffragette, about the movement to get the women the right to vote in the UK, is directed by a woman. I'm going to be seeing it on Tuesday night at the Arclight, a Q&A to follow with Carey Mulligan and Meryl Streep.
Fantastic.
So that will be cool. And the other thing that heartens me is apparently this month, Turner Classic Movies, I think on Tuesday and Thursday nights, are shining the spotlight on trailblazing women behind the camera.
Ah, behind the camera. Fantastic.
Yeah. So clearly,
they've been listening to the podcast.
The influence of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour is felt. What I did see was the documentary Merchants of Doubt from Robert Kenner, who did Food, Inc. Did you see Merchants of Doubt, Dean Haglund?
No.
This,
tell me about it.
This is about how, first of all, the same publicists and the same quote-unquote scientific skeptics who for decades managed to cloud the issue surrounding the harms of cigarette smoking, then moved into the debate over retardants in furniture. You know, the whole thing about how these harmful cancer-causing chemicals needed to be in all our couches for 15, 20 years, despite
right.
the fact that they were proven not to in any way be fire retardant, and all they did was cause really big health problems in women and children. They were the exact same people who were muddying that debate. And lo and behold, all these same figures are now turning up as the people who are grinding policy change regarding climate change to a halt. It's the same scientific skeptics. It's the same publicists. It's the same people who worked for big tobacco that are now working for the oil companies to stop meaningful action on climate change. So that's one part of the film, is to show that connection. They could have done a better job, I think. I mean, I drew those connections. I think they could have done a better job of really underscoring those linkages for people. But I think at some point it gets lost in it. So I'm not sure structurally whether the film is a great documentary. But the thing that's fascinating about it is that it really shows in very clear, undeniable terms that it has not been a scientific debate for more than 15 years. In fact, they show all the, like, you know, the presidential, Republican presidential debates from 2000 and 2004, and how everyone admitted that something needed to be done about climate change. And then those same people on the stage 8 years later would go, well, we don't know if it's man-made. But of course there's no scientific debate, because every single scientific paper, not every article, every scientific paper, every single paper from 92 to 2002 all led to the same results, that it's real, that it's man-made, and that we need to do something about it as quickly as possible. But what the film shows in talking to these people, these supposed experts, these supposed, you know, think tank people, what it shows is that this is not a scientific debate. They acknowledge it's not about the science. It really boils down to an ideological debate about the role of government.
Wow.
And that's really? Why, shocked as we were that your friend Alex Jones would come out so hard against the idea of climate change, that he would be a denier, it actually makes sense, because they are using effectively so many libertarian groups, so many skeptic groups, because they play this card of the government can't be trusted, and these programs that the government wants to do are just to give the government more power. And
wow.
So they've managed to turn enemies of their own into allies by pitting them against other enemies.
That's pretty cool.
Well, it's not cool. It's terrible.
It's terrible, but that's cool that that's a documentary that's out there. I mean, and to have that information be relevant, you know, because so many times you don't think anybody's talking about that.
Yeah.
So it's kind of pleasing to hear that that's actually a thing.
And it is. What's amazing about it are the few, like, very right-wing conservatives who now are considered, socialist because they believe in climate change, even though they're, like, would get the best grades from the NRA and the best grades, you know, from all the conservative, the Congress people from the reddest states who just happened to be on the science committees and saw it for themselves and realize that this is beyond an ideological issue or a political issue or a scientific issue. It's now become a moral issue. You know, that their own Christian belief now tells them they have to do something about it.
Right.
Which is fascinating. You know, mentioning the NRA, I was thinking about them when actually reading David's, posting about equity, you know, thinking about, like, when we talked about guns in this country before, about how many NRA members I've talked to, you know, have such real, very reasoned points of view and some really good ideas of how to keep guns away from the wrong people and how to make sure that, you know, training on guns. And they have so many interesting ideas that don't ever get discussed because they're not mentioned ever or brought up by the NRA leadership. And I wonder if someday we'll see maybe the NRA membership someday suing their lobbying leadership. I could see that happening. I could see it.
That would be some exciting development. Makes me want to join the NRA just to do that.
Yeah. Well, you're not here in this country, Dean Haglund.
Oh, so I can't join?
I don't know. Maybe. Would there be national rifle associations in other countries? I don't know. That seems weird.
No, that would be an international.
Exactly. House.
INRA, yes. Or my IRA.
I saw Ministry of Fear. I saw one classic film. This is from Fritz Lang, another one of his film noirs.
Yes.
This one's set in London. But I have just been on such a Fritz Lang kick since seeing, you remember I was really immersing myself in German Expressionism earlier this year. And since then, I've just gone on this string. After seeing Testament of Dr. Mabuse, I saw 1936's Fury starring Spencer Tracy, 1941's Manhunt starring Walter Pidgeon and George Sanders. I saw The Big Heat with Glenn Ford from 1953.
Such a classic.
While the City Sleeps, 1956, Dana Andrews, George Sanders again, Ida Lupino, Vincent Price, such good stuff. But I bring this up because I heard that you gave a little talk about Fritz Lang's Metropolis.
I certainly did. We did, I think it was quite lengthy, if I'm not mistaken, a 45-minute, quite in-depth dissertation on some of the aspects of Fritz Lang's Metropolis, 1927 silent film, both its deeper meanings, its acting styles, and its personal contribution to my creative life. And it was quite enjoyable, actually. I'm not sure where that will ever be heard, though. Part of a
they're going to make the podcasts available. This is a piece that you did. I did a piece about Logan's Run, and these are for people who attend an ongoing cinema series bringing back classic science fiction films to the big screen in Lincoln in the UK. But the podcast form of it will be made available for a broader audience at some point.
Excellent.
Who knows? Next thing you know, it'll your discussion will end up on a Criterion Collection edition someday.
Wouldn't that be something?
I saw two new releases, both of which are outstanding award hopefuls. One is from Lenny Abramson, who directed a film that came out last year called Frank that several of our listeners have said we need to check out.
So
we might need to see that movie. But it's a movie called Home, and it's based on Emma Donoghue's novel that seems based on real-life cases of abducted women, but just did its homework. It's not actually an adaptation of any true story. It's more of an amalgam, and as the writer said, as harrowing as this movie is, it barely scratches the surface at how harrowing an experience such an abduction and surviving such an abduction really is, and the post-traumatic aftermath of surviving such an abduction. But as the writer said, if we went any deeper into accuracy, no one would ever want to watch it. Indeed, you know.
Well.
So it's a very thought-provoking movie, so full of truth, and with a performance by Brie Larson, who won such acclaim for Short Term 12 last year. It is just, oh my God, I don't know if I've ever wept as much during a movie.
Oh.
It's called Room, and it's about a five-year-old boy basically keeping his mother alive while they are abducted, and again, once they get out and are freed from that abduction, the boy keeping her alive. So it's it's really, really run, don't walk, as they used to say, to your local cinemas. To see
and it's called
Room.
Room. Wow. But not The Room.
No, not The Room. That would be needing a five-year-old to help you escape from a Tommy Wiseau screening. The other one I saw, big ensemble. It combines my love of All the President's Men with my love of ensemble dramas, and it's Spotlight from writer-director Tom McCarthy. It tells the story of the Boston Globe Spotlight investigative team that in 2002 broke wide open the investigation into the Archdiocese of Boston and its cover-up. A systemic cover-up of child abuse, which of course then led to the investigations in countless other cities around the world where the exact same systemic abuse and cover-up of said abuse was found to exist. And it stars Mark Ruffalo as the lead investigator, Michael Keaton as his editor, John Slattery as Ben Bradley Jr., Liev Schreiber as Marty Baron, the editor-in-chief of the Boston Globe, Rachel McAdams is another one of the reporters, Stanley Tucci as the kind of crazy-seeming lawyer who is pursuing these cases. Who else? Billy Crudup as a corporate lawyer who seems shady at first, but then turns out to be a little bit different than you expect him to be. So, you know, quite an august ensemble cast. But the thing that you love, though, is that whenever it comes down to meeting someone who was there, meaning, you know, a witness to these events, which would be what? Either priests, for the most part, or their victims. These are actors you've never seen before who are given the spotlight, for lack of a better word, and who absolutely kill, surrounded by these big name actors. It is such a fantastic approach, this combination of, you know, the name actors with the unknown and who plays what part. It's terrific. Tom McCarthy, you may remember, wrote and directed the fantastic The Station Agent, which launched Peter Dinklage's career and also Bobby Cannavale and starred Patricia.
And he did Up too, didn't he?
He wrote Up. Yeah. He wrote and directed the Oscar nominated The Visitor, which got Richard Jenkins, his great character actor Richard Jenkins, got him a Best Actor nomination. So you know, when we're celebrating the work of great character actors, we could just go through Tom McCarthy's filmography, basically. He then did Win Win, which was that really fun movie about a wrestling coach starring Paul Giamatti and also starred Jeffrey Tambor. But what I was shocked to see was he had a film come out last year called The Cobbler, starring Adam Sandler, which almost went straight to Netflix. Netflix bought it. It had a limited theatrical run. It is known as the biggest box office flop of Adam Sandler's career, and it has 9% positive reviews. So this from the guy that made The Station Agent, The Visitor, Win Win, and Up, and he does a movie with Adam Sandler, and it gets 9% positive reviews. So I guess, in answer to the question, what do you get when you cross Tom McCarthy with Adam Sandler? You get Adam Sandler.
Right.
There's no way to win. There is no way to win in that.
So, and he's a bored cobbler bored with his everyday life, and he stumbles upon a magical heirloom that allows him to become other people and see the world in a different way.
I'm sorry.
That's the log line to The Cobbler.
I think we got nothing but static.
It's not jumping off the page.
Nothing but static came through when you read that log line. I mean, it was like the adults in Peanuts on this. Anyway, Spotlight, you'll love it. And like I said, I mean, you can love it on so many levels. And you know, what's fantastic about it is it doesn't try to over-dramatize anything. It just, it knows something so fundamentally important to the art of acting, which is people doing their jobs is interesting to watch if you really believe that you're watching them do those jobs.
Wow. That's so rare.
It is.
Kind of movies.
It is. But isn't that why All the President's Men work? Hoffman and Redford, biggest stars in the world, but don't you believe, for some strange reason, I know I'm watching Robert Redford, but I believe that's his cubicle.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's so you'll really, you'll really love it. Spotlight.
Can't wait.
So we're not going to cover a female-directed film this week. However, we will make mention of the fact that, as was discussed by our esteemed guest co-hosts, Lily Holloman and Karen Foreman, at the beginning of the summer, there was rumors that this was going to happen, and indeed it now has come to pass. There will be a federal investigation into claims of discrimination against female directors in Hollywood after the American Civil Liberties Union asked the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission to investigate whether Hollywood is violating Title VII. A few months back, as Lily and Karen said, the ACLU sent a round of letters to the commission, to the California Department of Fair Employment and Housing, and the Labor Department's Office of Federal Contract Compliance Programs, along with detailed statistical and anecdotal evidence, which they believe shows overt sex stereotyping and implicit bias. And according to IndieWire, the EEOC has begun their investigation into gender discrimination in Hollywood by sending out letters to women directors asking them to come in and meet in October so that the organization can learn more about what's going on in the industry. I don't know what the federal government can do about this, but what I love about it is the more ink that can be spilled on this, the better.
And absolutely. You bring that to attention and suddenly everybody goes, oh, yeah, why is there no female director? Why aren't we looking at female directors for this sort of thing?
Yeah. And as we've talked about before, you know, you, the listener, are sweet smelling. easy on the eyes, listeners. Seek out movies directed by women. Seek out the ones we talk about in this show. Seek out the ones that are available. Seek out the ones that come out into theaters. Seek them out. If they sound remotely interesting, go the extra mile and support them so that there will be more of them. We know this to be true. It's not just giving women an opportunity. It's giving them the opportunity to make mistakes and try things and fail as much as men are. And I know for a fact that's where some bias really takes place.
Right.
That first opportunity might be allowed, but you know how hard that second movie is to make? Because you want to go deeper. That's why so many people's second movies seem like a step back.
Right.
They're not. They're part of the evolution of an artist, but for women, it's so much harder. They have to really 100% try to do that thing they did before, which means they've already lost. They've already lost. So... here endeth the lesson, and I will put away that soapbox for right now.
Fantastic.
Hey, you know what? I just heard the dogs, and I was worried when we turned this show into a transatlantic link that I wouldn't get to hear the Dobermans lapping up water anymore. That, of course, has not changed. But what is different is now I set up the equipment, and today when I reached into the big silver briefcase that contains so much audio goodness, I got bit. Because Fuzz Aldrin had decided to nap inside it.
Really? That's Buzz Aldrin's place now?
Fuzz Aldrin. Not Buzz Aldrin. Yes, but we don't know where Buzz is. Buzz is on the convention circuit.
Fuzz Aldrin.
Hey, have you been keeping up with any of the new TV that's been coming down?
I've been trying, but, you know, it seems it doesn't sort of lay out the same way down here as it does up there.
Yeah.
Tell me what's coming down the pike that I may or may not have seen.
Well, you know, I watched the first few episodes of Quantico. Priyanka Chopra show. It reminds me a bit of Alias, reminds me a bit of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., reminds me a bit of How to Get Away. It reminds me a bit of actually every single ABC show. They all have the same tone. No, they really do. It's kind of stunning. And I would say, I guess, good for them. Anyway, it's utterly ludicrous through and through, and yet they may still get me back for episode 4. I don't know.
Wow, really?
But they had me going for a while. I watched the best new comedy, at least given its first couple episodes, that I've seen in many, many years. It's called The Grinder on Fox.
Ooh.
And it is about Rob Lowe, who plays a TV lawyer, think Alan Shore on Boston Legal. His show runs out. He decides to take some time off and goes back to visit his old family in the hometown where his dad and his brother run a real-life law firm. And he realizes he has missed his family so much that he just wants to stay there. And given all these years of his playing a lawyer, why not just study to pass the bar and join them in the family business? So it's so that's a funny enough premise. Rob Lowe rolls out of bed funny, really. His brother is played by Fred Savage, and who knew we were going to get to see him again in a show? And he's the real deal, man. He is such a good comedic actor, Fred Savage.
Really?
Yeah, the perfect foil. I mean, kind of how Jason Bateman was oh my goodness, what's the show everyone loves?
Arrested Development.
Arrested Development. Back when it first came on, kind of that level of good of a straight man. But one of the motifs that's so great is every episode, Rob Lowe is showing episodes of his show to his young nephew and niece and his dad. So they're going back and binge watching his show from the beginning. And so you get the plot of the episode, you get the plot of the show within the show episode.
Fantastic.
And like episode 2 was all about Rob Lowe telling his family how hard second episodes are. Because you have to reset the premise without losing your original audience, but also hopefully welcoming some new people in. And anyway, it's hysterical. It's like I said, the best new comedy I've seen in a long, long time. And it's paired with one of the worst, most tired sitcoms I've seen in a long, long time, Grandfathered, starring equally handsome 50-year-old white guy, John Stamos.
Right.
So
you got two equally handsome 50-year-old guys on TV at the same time.
Right. And one show is excellent and one show is terrible because nature abhors a vacuum. The other thing that I've finally been watching and catching up on is because it kind of turned me off at first when I saw it. And you must have seen some of these. Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee?
Yes, I've been watching the first two seasons for sure.
Because they're on season, what, seven now? Season six, seven?
Well, I don't know. You know, I don't know what, how a season, what is it, five comics he has coffee with? That's a season?
Yeah, I don't know. Now, but yeah. But you've never, this hasn't really thrilled you?
Originally, it was kind of like, oh, this is going to be really insightful. I thought the one where it's him and Kramer, mm-hmm. Michael Richards,
yeah.
was deeply emotional and fantastic. But other ones seem very superficial and they have nothing to say. And they're, you know, and they're driving a nice car. So
it really does seem like it has to be a stand-up comic whose work he admires.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it's just him working out shtick.
Yeah, or waiting for some shtick to happen, because I saw somewhere where he showed outtakes, and there is like not just minutes, but tens and twenties of minutes where the two guys aren't saying anything; they're just eating or just hanging out, staring out the window before they say something. So they're editing in just the good bits, but I could see that if. The two guys have nothing to say, they're not going to say anything.
It is a great concept, and I will keep watching them. But it is a little bit hit or miss, depending on who the guest is. The one with Letterman is terrific.
Yes.
It is so funny. Letterman clearly is having a ball in it. Whereas the one with Colbert, not so good. Because Colbert never did stand-up. I mean, that's so it doesn't seem like there's a lot for them to talk about. Even though Colbert brings some great, great bits to it.
For sure.
There was a letter that we got, an email from a listener, Barry Murphy, who wrote us chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com, as people should.
And he wrote, as one should.
He wrote to us about the problem of, quote, peak television. It was a rather lengthy email, and I think the rather brilliant points he makes apply to both television and film. And it boils down to this, as I read it, which is an idea that the seemingly good in television, and like I said, also I believe in film, is starting to get in the way of the great. You and I have talked so much about binge watching. We talk about the appeal of it. But so much of what makes something bingeable is a plot that hooks you and keeps you. And it does so at the expense of character development. So it's only going to rise or fall on the strength of its plot, which only goes so deep. Though we don't, ultimately, when we think back to the works we love the most, that move us the most, remember plot. That's actually the least of it. It's really about story, and story comes out of character. And I was thinking about this concept because, truthfully, the bar has been risen where when you see a bad show, you really wonder now, like, how the hell did this get made? There are competence should be expected now. For many years in television, even competence got rewarded. But now that should be the bottom line. And I'll say this about film, for example. You know, we just big studio films, big budget films, they've been getting better for the most part. And so they're all pretty good. Good or pretty good. You look at the Rotten Tomatoes and you go, okay, this one got 78% of the reviews, of good reviews, because it's competent. And that was never the case. And so the thing is, though, if you have this film that gets 80% positive reviews on Rotten Tomatoes and has enough money behind its marketing to push that it got 80% on Rotten Tomatoes, you are not going to hear about the truly great film that probably doesn't have a marketing budget behind it. Whereas even 5-10 years ago, there was such a dearth of quality that the cream could rise. Those foreign film, those independent films, they really could rise and get known by a wider audience. And I think it's happening in television, too. The good shows are starting to get in the way of the great shows.
Interesting. So that if I am some auteur that just suddenly out of nowhere, and no one knows my competence, as it were, but I hit something out of the park amazingly, it's not going to get the marketing muscle behind it because no one knows for sure if it's brilliant or not because it's a complete unknown.
I read an interview with you where you basically talked about, look, where are you going to put your marketing budget? Because you've got to start that marketing campaign before the thing's even made. So where are you going to put it? You're going to put it behind the thing that has the most going for it from a marketing standpoint. And this is why we see so many, now on television especially, revivals, reboots, adaptations, remakes, not just in film, in television as well.
Yeah. Yeah. And think of even, you know, when else in history are they redoing Spider-Man every 10 years? Like, does every generation need a new Spider-Man?
Every generation gets the Spider-Man it deserves. Let's do this. Wait. We've been talking about this for weeks. Let's talk about the remakes, reboots, adaptations, and the occasional tidbit of interesting development news.
Fantastic.
Starting with the big screen, Sicario, which is an excellent film that we haven't discussed, starring Emily Blunt and Benicio del Toro. That Benicio del Toro, every 15 years, as long as you make a movie about the drug trade on the border, he's going to become relevant again.
Yeah.
And a sequel was announced before even the opening day of Sicario, and it will be focusing on Benicio del Toro's character in the Emily Blunt actioner. And so I thought that was interesting. It was a go even before the film opened nationwide. And of course, it did open to the biggest per screen average of the year.
Oh, right.
So we'll be looking forward to a sequel to that.
I can't wait.
Something that I think is kind of interesting is that for all the dystopian adaptations that Hollywood produces, which I rail against because I say, where's that future that's worth living for, that's worth fighting for? Few utopian science fiction projects are ever made, and that's not a new phenomenon. But apparently that is poised to change now that Octavia Butler's 1987 novel Dawn, the first book in her Xenogenesis series, has been acquired for a new TV series adaptation. Now, these books won multiple Hugos and Nebula Awards. Did you read these? Are you a fan or familiar with these?
They're on my bookshelf, but I haven't read them personally, so I can't wait to see them. I'll read them now so that I'm up to speed when it comes on the big screen.
One of the reasons, of course, that I'm excited about it, going all the way back to one of the reasons I love Star Trek so much, is that this will be that rare sci-fi adaptation to prominently feature persons of color. Imagine that, a future where it's diverse and people all work together.
That'd be something.
The author, Octavia Butler, by the way, was the first science fiction author to win a MacArthur Genius Grant. She wrote about human bloodlust, unnecessary hierarchies, including our constructs of gender, race, and sexuality. But in this book series, she also offered a range of solutions, many of which, since 1987, have proved wonderfully prescient since their publication. So that is some cause for optimism in terms of development. I didn't want to jump right into the negative, Dean Haglund. I wanted to talk about... we're never going to be rid of comic book movies, for example, right? We're never going to get...
Right.
There has to be another Thor movie because even though that second one, that second Thor movie was so deadening, what's your line, Dean?
The culture of the snake eating itself and then crapping that out.
Oh, I was going to say it made your butt so Thor you couldn't fit for weeks. But anyway... In negotiations right now to direct the third Thor movie, Ragnarok, for Marvel, wherein Mark Ruffalo will be bringing his Hulk to the film. Taika Waititi, the director of What We Do in the Shadows, which we talked about a couple of weeks ago, director of Flight of the Conchords. He is negotiating to direct this, and how excellent would that be, especially combined with the news that Ruffalo is bringing the Hulk to the film, because there's some real opportunities for some comedy then.
Yes. Wouldn't that be something for a change in one of these things?
Now, I might be out of good news. Let's see.
Damn it, I was feeling so happy here.
We're getting a new Escape from New York movie. Reboot to be written by the creator of Luther, Neil Cross. And the fact that the creator of Luther is doing it makes me all the more sad about it. You know, again, we don't need a remake. I refuse to, you know, go against my words. I mean, it's fine. Go ahead and remake them. More people will find out about the original that way. But don't we need the guy who created Luther creating more original content?
Yeah, more Luther stuff. Because Escape from New York was also an expression of post-70s bankruptcy of New York City, of Manhattan. And so this was the idea of if we follow the bad times from the subway strikes to the blackouts to how Manhattan itself became a crime-ridden area for some sociological reasons, and that the fear was that could never turn around. And in fact, it did turn around. And Times Square became a family entertainment mecca. All of Manhattan is now a lovely place to visit. Relatively, there was a Tuesday 2 months ago where not one single crime was reported anywhere on the island, the first time in its history. And yet we're now going to redo a movie that's expressing this 1970s fear.
I know.
Seems ridiculous. So
you're looking forward to it. Okay, moving on to another one.
Yeah, put me down for a check mark on that one.
I know this probably bothers you to no end, the fact that one of my all-time favorite musicals is the Disney film Mary Poppins. But we can both probably agree that, although we would probably disagree on the quality of that film, we can both disagree that we probably don't need Into the Woods director Rob Marshall directing a reboot of Mary Poppins for Disney, an all-new story following the nanny and the Banks family in London during the 1930s.
How did the family sign off on this when you saw Saving Mr. Banks?
I know.
And how she was so adamant of not getting this movie made in the first place.
And if you don't have Julie Andrews and Dick Van Dyke, why? But, you know, who knows? The head scratchers continue. Sony, thank God, is rebooting Charlie's Angels.
Oh, my God. What?
Actress and Pitch Perfect 2 director Elizabeth Banks is signed on to helm. Now, I didn't realize that Pitch Perfect 2 was directed by a woman. Here's the thing. I had never heard of Pitch Perfect until Pitch Perfect 2 came out. I'm the proud owner of Pitch Perfect on Blu-ray. Someone gave it to me. So I guess maybe I have to see it so that I can see Pitch Perfect 2 because it is female directed. So good for her. I'm glad it was a hit. I guess I'm glad that a woman is directing Charlie's Angels. Who knows what her take will be? Elizabeth Banks is a brilliant comedic actress.
Yes, she's got the timing down, and she's
so maybe she can do something with this. Maybe it could be an Anchorman kind of a pastiche, because, you know, the thing about Charlie's Angels was fascinating that it, when it came along in the late 70s, you know, you can think of it as just, you know, the jiggle entertainment, right? The kind of exploitation of the bombshells. But the truth was, it was kind of this interesting midpoint, because it also embodied this sort of feminist vibe, because the women were the only effective ones. They were cops. The men were subordinate. So they got to have their cake and eat it, too, was the
That's true. Was the thing. It started as a brilliant Aaron Spelling double-edged sword, in that they were both sexy yet in control, but, you know, they often directed it towards the male audience, and then had the storyline be directed towards a female positive.
Look, I mean, it's exactly what they'll say about us. Sexy, but in control. But 10 years from now, no one's really going to want this to be rebooted. Okay. Ellen Page, we'll just do a lightning round here. Ellen Page is in talks to be in a Flatliners reboot. Remember Flatliners with Julia Roberts and Kevin
where
Bacon.
They killed themselves.
Yeah, just to see what was after death. Good.
Yeah.
So apparently what's after death is more reboots. Now, John Wick 2 begins filming this fall.
Okay.
So
I really want to see John Wick 1.
So you better get on that then.
Yes. Or the two won't make sense.
Ridley Scott, who's The Martian, is doing quite well, going to get a lot of awards, breaking box office. I don't know if it's breaking box office records, but it's doing great. He wants to make three more Prometheus movies, with the fourth one connecting to the Alien franchise. But then in another interview, perhaps jokingly, he said the next one has the following title, Alien: Paradise Lost, and said that it will be a prequel showing how the beast was made. So, who knows? We've got anywhere from one to four more Prometheus movies where either the next one or the fourth one will tie it back to Alien.
Wow.
I don't even know.
I don't even know either. That seems...
Men in Black, Dean Haglund. Men in Black is being rebooted as a trilogy. It was a trilogy. It's being rebooted as another trilogy and without Will Smith. But of course it would be without Will Smith. Why would he want to do more sequels? Why? He's not doing Independence Day. Why would Will Smith, charming, talented, popular Will Smith, why? He does not want to do sequels. He will not do... Oh, wait, he's doing Bad Boys 3. Okay, never mind.
Oh, ouch.
20th Century Fox is in negotiations with Len Wiseman to direct and produce the sixth installment in its durable, though I think durable, given how bad and what a flop the last one was, should be in quotes, its durable 27-year-old Die Hard franchise. Bruce Willis is expected to return for Die Hard 6 in a story that would focus on the origins of the younger John McClane character, set in New York City in 1979. So do you see a motif? People are fascinated with the late 70s all of a sudden.
It's all of a sudden, yeah. And so what, he's going to be on a rocking chair in a porch going, yeah. Let me tell you, kid.
A narrative as a present-day version of John McClane. You don't need the origins. The origins of him are the first Die Hard. If you believed that he was anything other than an everyman blue-collar cop, Die Hard loses a lot of its luster.
It certainly does.
Ice Cube will be playing Scrooge. You heard me. In a contemporary retelling as a real estate mogul. So I guess this leads to a quick discussion of our favorite Scrooge adaptations. And I don't mind going first. I enjoyed The Muppets Christmas Carol. I'm not kidding. Michael Caine's brilliant in that. Sort of enjoyed Bill Murray and Scrooged. But I'm going to tell you, my favorite adaptation of A Christmas Carol is the final episode of The Next Generation, Star Trek The Next Generation. That was my favorite episode. And if you don't think that that was a remake, go back and watch it right now. It begins with Picard wandering through the halls in his dressing gown and a nightcap, asking people what year it is.
Look at that.
And it is past, present, future, goes to past, present, future. He sees all possibilities. It's an adaptation. I'm not joking. It's my favorite adaptation.
That's pretty good.
Oh, my God. I can't believe how much of this there is to get to. Skull Island is moving from Universal to Warner's, so that Warner's can, after its release and the release of their Godzilla 2, bring those two stars together in a film that would serve as the third in a trilogy for both. Yes, we're going to get Godzilla versus King Kong.
Which was really great in 1948, I think. Or was it 52?
The Imitation Games, Morten Tildum, will be directing Agatha Christie's And Then There Were None for Fox. Now, I don't know if this is going to be a period piece again. I hope so, because what good is it in a modern technology?
Yeah.
But that is a 1939 novel that has sold 100 million copies and is the all-time best-selling mystery novel. So I ask you, how do you keep that fresh?
Yeah, exactly. I think I know the end. Yeah.
Bryan Singer is stepping in for David Fincher in a remake of 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea.
Okay.
Which could be cool if it incorporated what we're doing to the world's oceans. That would be an interesting
idea.
There's
an environmental angle to it. That'd be great.
John Sayles, independent film legend John Sayles, has been tapped to write a new Django Western, which will again star Franco Nero after all these decades. So, I mean, I love that Franco Nero does a cameo, not as Django, as someone else in Django Unchained, so named because Quentin Tarantino loved the old Django movies, and now it leads to another Django.
I'm following you. It's culture and it's industry working together.
All right. So one last bit of film before we move to TV. One last bit of film development news that I am excited about. Alexander Payne, my old friend, is teaming with Paramount for the third time following election and the recent Nebraska. The studio is producing and distributing his next directorial effort, Downsizing. And it stars Matt Damon and Reese Witherspoon, who, of course, was so good in Election for Alexander Payne. It tells the story of an Omaha man who joins the throngs of people undergoing a new process that reduces people to a tiny fraction of their size and who move to one of the many communities of small people that are sprouting up around the world as an answer to overcrowding and reduced resources.
Yeah. Hey, that's pretty good.
Isn't that great that the problem is not downsizing? The problem is we need to literally downsize.
Yeah, right. We're just too big.
There is some excellent satirical opportunities in that.
I love it.
Now, television. HBO is eyeing a Watchmen TV series from Zack Snyder, who did the Watchmen adaptation on the big screen. And I think that makes sense to me. Doing it as
an
HBO
series. That makes sense to me, too. Yeah, the way that graphic novel, one of the best graphic novels of all time, was something that you read slowly, that it wasn't a two-hour condensed story. It was very sprawling, actually. So to have it as a series seems like a great idea.
And I'm glad. And he brought a lot of good stuff to that movie. If anything, I could understand people. I didn't know the graphic novel. I loved that he created a universe. He introduced the rules of that universe. He played by those rules. It was fascinating to me. Yeah. But I could understand why, you know, it needed oddly enough, because it was a big screen film, but it needed a bigger canvas. It needed, in terms of time.
But is the very eclectic writer Alan Moore signed off on this? Because he's always the very adamant, hates all of Hollywood. And
I will find out. I will find that out for you.
That's
and
the
let
big
you
question.
Know. The A-Team is being rebooted as a co-ed television series. Ooh, hooray. But at least diversity is being introduced to some of these. Heart to Heart, the old Robert Wagner, Stephanie Powers, frothy romantic mystery series is being remade on television with a gay couple.
Well, see, that makes sense to me. Who would have that kind of money and that kind of worry over some minor crime?
Following the Heart to Heart remake with a gay couple, which was set up at NBC, Sony Television is rebooting another classic 70s drama series from the Spelling Goldberg catalog, Fantasy Island, with a major twist. The project will again be at ABC with two female leads. Now, what everyone is ignoring is that this is the second remake because Malcolm McDowell and Madchen Amick starred in an adaptation of that series in the late 90s.
What? I did not remember that at all.
They did indeed. In the Line of Fire, the movie is coming to a TV series after 20 years, so the wait is over.
The wait is over. Thank goodness.
The wait is also over, Dean Haglund, because My Best Friend's Wedding is being remade as a television series for ABC. And did I mention that Lethal Weapon is coming to series for Fox Television, hot off the failure of Minority Report? So, again, the wait is over.
So, wait a sec. Lethal Weapon, like it's going to be, I'm still 3 days from retiring, but we're going to go through it. Well, every season is one day closer to retirement.
Let me just say this about the remake of Lethal Weapon as a TV series. I'm too old for this shit. A&E is remaking Roots. Did you see this? They're remaking the original Roots miniseries, lavish with big names and big directors. But still, I don't know. Do we need it? I mean, again, I guess the new one. I mean, the old one is always playing somewhere, and it was so groundbreaking. I don't know. It seems odd. Anyway.
Well, I guess the younger generation should see that series, and if they're not going to watch it because it's a 70s miniseries and they can't get around the archaic lighting and film stock, then maybe it should be remade.
Yeah, that film stock that always gets in the way of the kids enjoying something.
I don't know why kids don't want.
BBC Three has just announced that they are developing a new Doctor Who spinoff series titled Ooh. Class. And this Doctor Who spinoff will be set in contemporary London, and it hails from YA author Patrick Ness. It is set at the Coal Hill School, the fictional educational facility, where Doctor Who began all the way back in 1963's An Unearthly Child. The show is described as follows. Incredible dangers are breaking through the walls of time and space, and with darkness coming, London is unprotected. With all the action, heart, and adrenaline of the best YA fiction... That's a contradiction in terms right there. This is Coal Hill School and Doctor Who like you've never seen them before. Even though, as you know, I'm not a fan of Doctor Who because it hits a little too close to home for me. I am the Doctor. I was nevertheless a fan of Torchwood. So maybe the spinoff will be for the YA within my heart.
Right. They're all training to be into Torchwood, but then now they have to use the skills they have, not the experience, to go after all of that. I can see that.
We are so over time, but why not just keep going? Nielsen is going to finally start measuring total audience across linear and digital platforms.
Well, hello about time.
The networks have always used this, and you would think it would help. I mean, they've been using this, but they haven't been revealing what the numbers are.
Right.
You know, this is how Aquarius, the David Duchovny show, got a season two, because the ratings were very low, but they made the whole show available for binge watch from the beginning. And so apparently those numbers were very good, and which is why NBC would pick it up, even though they canceled Hannibal, despite Hannibal's better numbers. But it must have been because of the success on VOD of something like... but my question is, will Netflix be included? Will Amazon be included? Because they don't tend to provide these numbers. And if you don't have them, well, I don't know.
But they do... I think you can get those numbers. So if the studio can get the Netflix numbers and the Nielsen numbers, then they would have enough of a range to figure out how the show's doing.
As speaking of Amazon, the wait is over. Michael Bay is producing a Jack Ryan series for Amazon.
Oh, good. That'll be good. It'll be an odd plot device and lots of explosions.
And finally, let me end with some disappointing news about a revival that many of us are looking forward to, a classic revival that we talk about again and again and again on this show that featured David Duchovny. I, of course, am talking about Twin Peaks. Peter Sarsgaard, one of the great character actors I think we could celebrate. He is joined the cast in a recurring role of the Showtime revival. But the sad news is that Michael Ancine, who was last seen as an extra in Alexander Payne's The Descendants, an unspeaking extra role in The Descendants, he will not be returning to play Sheriff Harry S. Truman. He prefers to stay retired. And so the role of Harry S. Truman is apparently going to be recast. Rumors have it that it's going to be played by Robert Forster, who is a better actor, but I got to point out that the friendship chemistry was a true bromance between Ancine's Sheriff Truman and McLaughlin's Agent Cooper, and that really was the heart of that first season. In fact, when they moved away from exploring that friendship, the series kind of fell apart. So, you know, this would be to me like recasting the role of Mulder or Scully, but not both. You know, having one of the original actors, it would be that big a deal for the success of the show. As evidence of that, did maybe the X-Files suffer a bit of a downturn after Duchovny departed?
Yeah, what? Oh my gosh.
So anyway, sad news. I would rather them write in a new character and say that something happened to the sheriff.
Right.
You know, explore new characters, explore new stories. Again, let that town be the character and all the people who are drawn to it.
Right.
Well, that brings us to the conclusion of your Chill Pack 70 Minutes.
Wow. But packed 70 minutes.
We finally cleared the decks of so much stuff that we had to get to, Dean Haglund.
Yeah.
How can people find our shows?
Well, you can find so many of our shows just at going to our website, chillpackhollywood.com, where you can stream and do basically every
download, subscribe via iTunes, write a review on iTunes. That can be
Please
fun.
Please do.
Like us on Facebook. Fun.
Yes, we're at facebook.com/chillpackhollywood.
Follow us on Twitter.
We are at Dean and Phil. Spell out the word and.
Again, write us chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com.
So easy.
Thanks to Blog Talk Radio for hosting us, Fanboy Nation for carrying us, Empire State Gas for sponsoring us. From farm to pump, we've got great gas. Until next week, I am Phil Lairness.
And I am Dean Haglund. We'll see you then.
A day early next week, Dean Haglund.
Thank you.
Belated spoiler alert.